Hello, I'm Stephen Fry, a trustee of the Royal Academy of Arts and very proud to be so. Welcome to our podcast.
Thanks for inviting me, first of all, to what I consider to be a very intense lecture series and a series of debates I discovered. Because Owen put forward, I think, a very challenging position paper and has invited a series of critics of architecture, which will certainly of a cast that puts the heat on us very heavily. And there's a series of kind of anti-capitalist challenges, a lot of moral charge, but I think at the same time, although they are kind of pervasive in a certain intellectual intelligentsia culture, they are all of them based on fallacies, and I will pick through those. Because it's very important that I come here and make some arguments. The arguments will be twofold. On the one hand, I want to recognize that architecture in recent years has been politicized. That has to do with many aspects of culture and society having been politicized since 2008 with the financial crisis, Occupy movement, Arab Spring, European debt crisis, Greece, Spain. I mean, there's so much going on that occupies a lot of airspace everywhere and is also pushing heavily into architecture. So that's the first thing we have to recognize, address. But also I think it's important to protect a zone, an airspace for architecture and architectural discourse beyond the kind of its political ramifications. Now, I have been equally politicized and politically charged up since 2008. But in a very different direction, not in the kind of retro direction back to the 70s, which Corbyn represents and has a huge following. I'm moving, and I'm excited about a new direction, has a new vehicle which I'm getting involved with, which is Lieberland, and at the Chicago Architecture Biennale I will be announcing the international competition for designing Lieberland. It's basically a micronation, anarcho-capitalist, libertarian micronation, which believes that there's a different answer and direction to the stagnation and problems we're facing in this kind of decade, rather than going back to the 70s. So just put that out there, I'd have a very strong political opinion, highly evolved political opinion, because also it moves through a series of stages to arrive at that. And I've also been involved already in the politicization of parametricism, the movement and candidate epochal style of the 21st century, parametricism. There was a conference I was speaking on, and there's a book just came out I can recommend called The Politics of Parametricism. And my article, it's a kind of keynote article in there, is called The Historical Pertinence of Parametricism and the Prospect of a Free Market Urban Order. So have a look at that. So architecture's politicization. I mean, you see it at schools where I'm teaching, and has been a vehicle of evolving parametricism, like the AA, which is more where it becomes politically charged up, a kind of debating club. The same at the Columbia University under the leadership of Mike Wigley, where there's far less design and much more debate about the direction of society. And I appreciate that and I appreciate the urgency. But the problem is at the same time that the project of designing for the 21st century has been kind of put on hold for quite a few years. The Venice Biennale, Pritzker Prize, all these institutional forums are, in a sense, validating charitable, political, critical achievements, and so there's no space, seems left, to discuss design. Now, this also affects us at Zahid Architects and Zaha Hadid, so we have this kind of whole swathe of politicizing, moralizing architectural critics, which I think are in the same vein and what the speaker's own has put together. Something like Ron Moore, Oliver Wainwright, you can read them through. They're key critics of The Guardian, of Observer, and other papers. That's the kind of new thrust and intellectual environment in which architecture is perceived primarily on political grounds and premises, with a kind of moral charge, and from a moral high ground sometimes even. So when news arrived in England and the world that we had to give up on 3 years of intense work on a beautiful Olympic stadium in Tokyo, we got this kind of response from it's typical to some extent, maybe no extreme sense, but that was the occasion, the announcement that we wouldn't be doing the Olympic Stadium, and the Guardian was said, yeah, this should happen much more often here, that, you know, arrogant architects are shown the way and put in their place. And here was an occasion for Stephen Bailey to say, you know, the locality Hadid prefers is the backyards of dictators and tyrants. Her latest buildings always win approval from supine architecture and design media, so work very well as salvation via design for repressive regimes. She has projects in various stages of completion or disarray in Libya, Iraq, Russia, Qatar, China, and Azerbaijan. We have projects in all these places. But of course, we also have projects in England and in Scotland, in literally every single European country. We had nearly in every city of Spain, France, Germany, and half of cities of Italy, we had projects. Some of them were stopped, of course, with the crisis. So we're thinking about what's happening. We had, of course, projects in the Americas, in the Middle East, and Asia. And here, of course, China is also picked out as something where it seems we're all compromised. And we should kind of boycott all these places, seems to be the message here. And, I mean, it seems okay that we all live off these places, consuming oil and the products of China, but including the critics, but there seems to be a kind of moral charge of hands off, and basically our hands are dirty, and we are put into our place, as it were. And, yeah, just as a reminder, that was the occasion that was kind of scrapped. And the next thing happened, which seems on more on a positive side, that Zadid got the Reba Royal Gold Medal. And the responses there were also occasions to rehearse a series of challenges and accusations which have been circulating in the last few years. So in the radio interview, the first, you know, Zadid had to answer questions about health and safety and dying workers in Qatar. Then the Tokyo issue came also up in a kind of challenging fashion, and she kind of refused to continue. There's been, of course, going viral, and then it was for the Spectator a reason to confirm, yes, her aggressive performance implies that architecture would be better off without her. So I'm showing to this, you know, you can make excuses. I mean, some of these papers have to write stories, and there's underlying serious issues, but you can see that the kind of atmosphere of leftist, left-liberal critique and its focus is really making us a kind of free-for-all. We are kind of we can be beaten up and pushed and from some kind of moral high ground. I guess the implication is that, well, we'll talk about later what the implication should be. So, but we keep in a good mood, because we have, you know, tons of clients around the world, with various degrees of sophistication and political credentials, if you like. And also we have 400 people in the office who seem not to be worried about, you know, we are meant to kind of protest and withdraw from all these jobs. And but people, the young people, who some of them are here, don't have that problem. They don't say, hey, by the way, I don't want to work in this country, that country, this project, and because I have real problems with that. They don't do that. Nobody came to us, and we're not kind of tyrants who wouldn't be sensitive to this. So let me just go through very, very quickly where we are supposedly compromising ourselves. And when we first started China, there was a lot of heat, and even colleagues were saying, you know, I would never go to China. With the human rights abuses and so on, so we can't work there. But what are we actually doing there? I mean, just clicking through that is opera houses, Youth Olympic. I mean, there's a lot of work, and I think progressive and life-enhancing work, showing the way of how we can address metropolitan conditions in the 21st century. And of course, there's contrasts still and ruggedness and juxtapositions, and this is going on, but, you know, is this condition the problem, a fault of this, or is this you know, a solution to these conditions, one might ask. Very, very progressive clients with you know, work shared, bookable, online bookable tables. So you can right now book office space and offer tables or short notice in Beijing, if you like. And we've literally millions and millions of square feet or square meter even finished on the construction in Beijing. And there were dense metropolitan conditions. We also do things for the government. I mean, some of these projects for government, some of these are private. So this is Beijing New Airport, which we're designing and moving forward with. We're also having on site a project, new cultural project in Changsha, with a museum, opera house, and various conditions. So that's what we're doing. So dirty hands, or should we kind of stop doing this and join the ranks of the critics? I just came from Russia. Russia is, of course, the land of the oligarchs, of Putin, of human rights abuse, etc., etc. Well, we're building, and we just finished a forward-looking and progressive, I would argue, workplace, kind of peripheral to the center, but for multi-tenant office space with conferencing and restaurant facilities, public facilities on the ground floor, and a lot of cool people will be gathering here, right? And some of the aesthetics and the expression means also you need to navigate a city like this so that cool people, which are relevant to each other, actually can gather, and they will gather in a place like this. And it's a cool thing, and it has a series of attractions and openness, and when you move in, it becomes a kind of interesting public, semi-public, let's say, community space, graphic space, dense space for interactions across the various firms which are gathering in this building. And also some of these moves, this kind of push with the cantilevers, means also that you have this kind of totally column-free, mullion-free projection actually through the whole building, out into the city, across the atrium, through the other side of the city. Nice event spaces and so on. We just came back yesterday from that. And we had a nice after party at Strelka, an architecture school who... And you can see kind of a place like Russia isn't equals Putin, equals hands off. It's you have many friends and people there, creatives, and who want to change the conditions there in our buildings will make a contribution. Now, well, there's also these kind of things. This is true oligarch territory in terms of a kind of fabulous dream house villa, where I think I'm sure we'll get a lot of heat of this. This is friend Vladislav up there, our client. And what is this? So, how do you justify this? I mean, first of all, it's very tough to resist doing this. But from the way I see it is in two ways. One is he's financing a kind of research program in technology. This is a smart house with a lot of manufacturing challenges, structural challenges. It's also you also have to see that somehow the rich people often, the pioneer consumers, which make these things possible, make automobile possible. There's always at the beginning of that a necessary challenge of a kind of pioneering consumption. And I guess, it's for us, it's a kind of, he's financing our architectural research. And we do that in China as well. There's another of those characters we do a penthouse for. And we do, of course, in New York, we've now landed and creating places for the 1% in New York, in Miami. Maybe this is more than 5% in Singapore. This is 1,500 units for well-off people in Singapore who together to live in various places. And I mean, that takes a lot of hard work. But also you need to think of it this way. So if this is the top 1% or 5%, that means they have a lot of consumption power because they have earned a lot and have a lot of money. But what is money if it isn't a certificate of service? So that means they have served so many to pull this, and all these men and they only continue to serve those monies, one could argue, if they have things to purchase, things to know. What's the point of owning creating such great markets, such enhancement across the world, where we all know that our life has been super enhanced by these kind of products, and that we would pay much more than the few hundred dollars for this, and we would still want to have it, so that we have a huge consumer surplus for everybody. and accessible. And but if there wasn't this kind of superlative for those who actually make this possible and make all of us happy, then that would you wouldn't be incentive to create these things in the first place. So anyway, this is a discussion we could have. We're also doing resorts in China. We're doing toys like this. You might find questionable. Et cetera, et cetera. So we're also going into the Middle East, which is full of contradictions and problems and issues. And we've done that. And this is, of course, the run-up to 2008 was an intense, insane nearly period of activity. And so some of these things didn't get built. But, you know, a fabulous concert hall projecting over the water from Saadiyat Island in Abu Dhabi, in Dubai, the Opera House. I mean, these are all dream places. Jordan, the Amman Royal Opera House, and so on. You might question, is that what Amman and a city like this really needs and requires? But that's something, not our decision, but that's something which comes out of these countries and seems to be a demand, a desire, and a project which garners support. And we deliver too. We even go to places like Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Mubarak's Egypt, the huge kind of new Cairo office complex, and of course Azerbaijan, the Hadi Alef cultural center with museums, concert hall, etc. as a cultural center, and something again the conditions there could be debated, but we also know that BP is investing there. It's the largest investment. We draw oil. We have communication with them, and these we have to be can't measure all global conditions with a kind of single measuring rod, which is based on our latest achievement and demands. And I think we're doing these places a favor and ourselves a favor to engage in such works and projects. And this is the latest one in Sharjah, which is moving forward. More from Saudi Arabia, etc. Now, but we also, so not only working in these territories, we also directly working for political institutions. So this is Cambodia. We might be on the good books for this with certain critics on this, perhaps, but perhaps not. This is the Genocide Khmer Rouge Documentation Center in Phnom Penh. And it's a private initiative, but it also has government support. And the Cambodian government has, of course, problems, like most governments, which aren't the handful of most advanced countries. This is a parliament of Abu Dhabi, which we made proposals for. This is Syria, so we met with Assad, and we made proposals for a new parliament building complex in Damascus before this whole place went out up in flames. And we also worked with the Gaddafi regime. We worked under the leadership of Saif, and this is the People's Congress, 5,000 in Tripoli, which was proposed. So, I mean, this was interesting. Actually, there was, if you look at Libya as a case, before this, it all fell apart and moved horribly wrong. Is you had actually a renaissance of sorts with a lot of young, foreign educated Libyans coming out under leadership of Saif and trying to modernize the country and bringing in connections and work and. So the diaspora of the Libyans actually moved back. And you find that in many, many places. This is the cabinet offices for Baghdad, Iraq, which we made proposals for. We didn't win this competition. This is the Iraqi parliament complex with two houses and various auditoria. And that's something which might go forward. We're also doing Iraqi Central Bank. Which is also very much driven by sustainability and environmental issues. In this region, it's not advisable to do these kind of glass towers with massive air conditioning underneath. So this is moving forward. And Bouteflika in Algeria, a kind of presidential palace with various ceremonial and conferencing facilities. Some of the latest things we're working on. Perhaps one more to show is the Saudi Aramco managed King Abdullah Research Center. It's a research campus close to the university and from the way to the airport to Riyadh. Very much driven by a sense of campus life, but dense and concentrated and shielded from the sun. A hexagonal system which allows more connections with more neighbors for each cell and space than a grid would allow you, and with a heavy motivation to work with this very, very harsh climate in terms of sun protection and wind capturing, as well as solar capturing, etc. So very much an environmentally driven project, not through machines, but through architectural morphology. And you can just flick through some of these buildings. You can see the kind of depths of walls, the shading, and the richness of various spaces. So we have office spaces, we have conferencing facilities, library facilities, and a lot of porosity and connection and spaces together, outdoor spaces, shaded spaces, kind of internalized campus condition. Religious spaces, I'm kind of course, an enlightened atheist, if you like. But you know, we have to accept where cultures are and what cultures, how they want to express themselves and contribute to this. So this is the religious space, more spaces. Just go quickly through this. So. And again, I mean, we're happy. It's kind of a complex and contradictory world, and we get a lot of heat for doing all this. I mean, again, what's the alternative? I think the suggestion is to kind of withdraw from this in protest. Join the ranks of the critics. Leave these territories to their own devices, if you like. But again, we get Rowan Moore, who's been the head of the Architecture Foundation and now a key critic of Observer, coming out with this at the occasion of the gold medal, and carves in, I mean, fair enough maybe, but with exaggeration, so prodigiously expensive aquatic center, supposedly torpedoed the organized claim for sustainability because he's criticizing the steel roof because it has more tonnage than a tensile structure. But you can't do that. You have to look at the overall structure, first of all, and this is a LEED Gold project anyway, so we don't know where we... Not that I give much credit and I don't find it as a high priority necessarily. I think we have messed up our priorities sometimes when we're over exaggeratedly focusing on sustainability, but we are ticking these boxes. The Riverside Museum supposedly is dysfunctional and expensive. So the suggestion here is, and that I want to pick up on, first of all, our kind of architecture, which is interested in complexity. I will talk about more what the agendas are, what the advantages are, what the life-enhancing potentials of this are, that this is not an investment worthwhile making. So that we should, that's a waste of money, as if it was just our kind of self-indulgent, artistic, self-expression desire, which explains these architectures. That's a presumption, despite the fact that I've written 100 articles and various books, one running into over 1,000 pages, doesn't matter. It's just, you can just stay with your prejudice that this is just self-indulgence. And so, as if the justification of kind of imposing dysfunctionality and cost overruns was kind of a genius, insistent on a kind of genius, and that clients and audience are equally bewitched by such fetishisms. That's a presumption. I mean, it's just seems to be self-evident. So the masterpiece defense, the idea that talent and personal excuse almost anything. Not in my book. These works have advantages and a rationality which is superior to any prior styles which other people might want to go back to or insist on resting with. They are superior on many counts, certainly on technical counts, in terms of only Parmatism is able, in fact, to really make use of and garner the engineering intelligences and manufacturing intelligence which we are now having at our fingertips, whereas these potentials and capabilities are wasted in all other styles. The same is with, in terms of more sophisticated and adaptive and pliant and versatile adaptation to climatic and environmental conditions. Only Parmatism is, in fact, able to do that, etc., etc. He's also going in that we're doing dachas for oligarchs, condominiums in Miami, shopping centers in Beijing, World Cup Stadium Qatar, etc. As of all these things were equally questionable. I mean, what's wrong with shopping? I mean, it just becomes a kind of mindless barrage, nearly. And needs to be this kind of attacks need to be put in their place. Of course, he's recognizing that's good. I don't want to be over critical that everybody's in these territories. The Olympic Committee, multinational businesses, respectable cultural institutions, that's true. Mayor, the checker, everybody, and all of us are in there because we're consuming the produce and selling into these places. We're all in there together, of course. And again, the excuse that they're all in there, it only goes so far, it doesn't answer the fundamental question. What if architects such as Sadid were more principled in their choice of clients? What if they got together and formed a common front? Might that not be a force for good? Absolutely not. That's this kind of, you know, we're always withdrawing into a boycott. I mean, this is, it's never thought through. It's just stated there. Absolutely no, it is not a force for good. It's just delusion, self-delusion. Where else do we go? Here at least there's a sense of that we would, recognition that we have a theory of design, which is about to revolutionize, liberate the way people live in cities, etc. I think that's a very good point. But he doesn't buy it, he doesn't understand it, he doesn't grasp it, he doesn't find it convincing. I think it's just the rhetoric, the freedom of those forms does not translate into freedom for users, he's claiming. And that's the argument to make, and that's our failing. And I think we need to make these arguments more forcefully and carefully. I mean, it's not only in writings, which are not easy to penetrate always. So that's why I'm coming out and in lectures and debates to try to clarify what the advantages and life-enhancing qualities of these works, in fact, are. So, I mean, but there is really, in a lot of this, there is no specifically architectural criticism. There's no close reading. There's just, you know, gut reactions, this complexity, no, this is meaningless. It means it can only kind of be in the way of real life processes. And again, what's, you know, we don't need somebody like Ron Moore, and he has an architectural education and has been leading the architectural innovation, that cost overruns are something, you know, problematic, that we have sustainability issues to deal with, or, you know, certain technical functionality issues. Or he's alleging practical problems, which I think he's just alleging by prejudicial glances. So I think it's incredibly sloppy and problematic. But the point is this, that in an atmosphere where you have this kind of moral high ground taken and we are kind of pushed, it becomes easy to do that. And but I also find that once we engage into communication, I think these things open up. For instance, we get an enormous amount of shitstorms on the on the web and it's comments, barrages, and whenever I come up with something. But, you know, the point is, what I realized is that when I answer these points and pick them out one by one, and then there's people see, actually, we are not these monsters who are kind of bought by the oligarchs and only interested in money and are reckless and careless about people dying on sites and so on. We're not these monsters, right? And they find out very quickly once one comes back with a point. And I think that's very important. So I think... And I also want to keep the dialogue going with these characters. I'm not going to... I've been a bit harsh on Rowan, but I want to talk to him. I want to talk to the characters who've been invited here to lecture. I will come to the debates and try to explain what we're up to, what we're trying to do. And the fundamental premise for that debate to be going is that we actually believe it, we all have a similar agenda. You know, I'm not writing 100 articles to become wealthy. But that there's a real passionate and committed belief in that architecture matters, that I'm worried and following how societies evolve, what political trends are forming, and to participate in this. I believe in societal progress and want to contribute to this. So, you know, peace, guys. Cool off. Let's, you know, take the emotional charge out a bit. And start with the right premise here, you know. And what are we into? I mean, why are we? What are we doing? What's important? Peace. Peace is a condition, right? It's not only here, so we have an argument, but also out there in the world. Freedom. Freedom is a value in itself, and it's wonderful and powerful. But it's an absolute also condition for prosperity. We need to, you know, live well and live better. Freedom, prosperity, and that's a, you know, precondition of charity. We want to be charitable to each other, in a true sense. And that's what I'm all about. So, peace, let's take it for granted. Freedom, prosperity, charity. And freedom is many things. It's freedom of association, freedom of enterprise, freedom of contract, of trade, of consumption choices. Freedom to choose a medium of exchange, Bitcoin. Freedom from political control. And you can see here where I'm going with this. I'm a libertarian. I have made up my mind that I don't trust in majoritarian dictatorship, if you like. We can't wait before we do anything that everybody agrees, educated and half-educated, with all the interest and lack of attention. We have to allow individuals and entrepreneurs and anybody to charge forward and show the way. We don't need to have a nanny state kind of looking after that this kind of entrepreneur might do kind of do bad things. If he does, he will lose his capital very, very quickly. So these are the freedoms I believe in. Artistic freedom, yeah, of course, it's part of freedom of speech, if you like, but also I don't want to emphasize this. I put that in bracket and say, no, let's not overemphasize artistic freedom. I want to actually argue sharply between architects where we should be going, what we're doing, not with a gun on your head, with harsh mutual criticism argument in the domain of architecture. I prefer to talk with architects about architecture. I'll force you a little bit to make some political positions clear, perhaps, but I'm not going to, in this lecture, enter a detailed political debate or an exposition of libertarian economics and politics. So, but in terms of artistic freedom, no, it's artistic freedom, I put it in bracket. I don't give license and want to give license at this stage into the evolution of the new epochal style of pragmatism and where we are to a kind of a free-for-all, everybody doing what how they feel without being critiqued and challenged. So I put that in bracket. So what I said earlier is this. We have to have a frank, respectful, honest debate also across these ideological divides. All these characters, these kind of anti-capitalist, left-oriented critics, their moralizing kind of thrust. All the characters Owen has invited, and Owen himself, for me, they're all, you know, I want to talk to them because they at least share one thing, the pursuit of societal progress. I believe that. They're not indifferent, and for me, they're all potential converts to my way of thinking and working and looking at the world. So I think, but we, as I said earlier, we should do that debate without the negative hostile emotional charge, without all too quick moral condemnation, with a presumption of honesty and good intentions, with the necessary premise that all participants in this public debate, at least subjectively, share in the pursuit of societal progress. I certainly, that's what I'm all about. You might distrust that. Oftentimes I make arguments, oh, I'm just advertising Zahedin Architects. I'm just in there to project spin for my business. Fine. You want to believe that and ignore the argument, fine. But it's just not the premise of debate. So architecture, that's from Owen. In Owen's position paper, he's kind of putting out some notions. He's saying architecture was conceived as an instrument of social progress with the capability to improve people's lives. That's the kind of understanding that what modernism was all about. We all grant that modernism had that social project. But that somehow that got lost. Yeah?
I think I did say modernist architecture there.
Yeah.
Just for the record.
Absolutely, yeah. That's why I'm saying modernist. We attribute this to the modernists. And first of all, hey, if you look at the characters, Gropius, Mies, Korb, they were in a kind of socioeconomic groundswell that carried along with the movement and ferment. But at the same time, they were and had to. I think they were passionate and they were idealists in many ways. But today, architecture, according to Owen, is in the thrall of private interests and the needs of capital. First of all, I mean, problems with this. I mean, I think we all have. The protagonists of today are equally interested in this, and our architecture delivers precisely this. That would be my claim. But also that contradiction, that opposition between private interests and the kind of social wheel is fallacious. I mean, that is Adam Smith's 101, right? And the needs of capital, there are no needs of capitalists. which are different from the needs of capital actually needing to serve all of us to enhance our lives. So, first of all, yeah, for me, architecture remains an instrument of social progress. This must remain our premise, but also I believe it's a great fallacy to counterpose social progress and the market process. The market process is the incredible hit upon institutional process which delivered the modern world out of kind of depravity and backwardness and stagnation for thousands of years. It was the market process which delivered that and continues to do so. And in the contemporary world, in post-forest network society, all the more. There was a reason why we had a kind of a neoliberal renaissance, if you like, after some of the experiments and policies and processes of the 20th century, which I don't think necessarily were a mistake, but that would have been a mistake to continue with them. They were compatible with a mass industrialized, mechanized society of Fordism, let's say, and they became more and more not the vehicle and congenial to a computationally empowered, microelectronic revolution-driven post-Fordist network society, where markets become much more powerful, important, and potent. And I think we will talk about later in the debates, I think, that will, you know, all the new spaces of communication which are delivered by entrepreneurs, by markets, whether it's in America where shopping malls are, you know, where people are hanging out on, where, you know, private universities, a lot of private parks, but also all the communication spaces on the internet and markets themselves, whether you look at Facebook, Google+, eBay, they're all entrepreneurial creations. So, who is or should be afraid of capital? That means of the market. I would say that those who are unable or unwilling to make themselves useful to others, because that's what you do in markets. And as I said, money is a certificate of service. And there are two ways to get hold of money. By serving others better, with better products, using up less resources in the process. And that is what this profit signifies. If somebody makes a profit, it means he's creating value out of nothing, putting things together and creating that emergent surplus, that additional, which he then gives away and keeps a certain amount off. Whereas some, if you don't make a profit, then you're literally wasting resources. You're putting things together, your people's work, raw materials, and the outcome is less than you had. You're actually losing. You're making society poorer. And that's why profit is such an important and necessary signal which pushes resources into arenas and ways which serve and withdraws them, and they have to be withdrawn from arenas where they're just wasted and put in together in ways which make us poorer. Just a little bit of Austrian economics. So now I'm coming to Owen's position paper. Just to pick that apart, I mean, it's online somewhere, really online. I think you can only get... So I've got dealt with all this already. Architecture is beholden to the needs of capital. Yes, we all should be. The needs of capital are the needs of the market, the needs of all of us. And capital formation is very, very important. And also capital reallocation is incredibly important. I mean, you know, I mean, there's so many fallacies. People don't get it, understand, for instance, that if I'm a billionaire, Warren Buffett, who is controlling a huge amount of assets, well, yes, the first distinguish between his personal consumption and these assets he's actually directing and redirecting in away from waste into gifts for all of us. And for that, he takes a certain slice. So it's incredibly potent and powerful social contribution to all of us. These kind of speculators just, you know, speculate with their own wealth and with some other people's wealth. Because these savings need to be reinvested properly, otherwise they waste away. And if you have government stepping in, it always leads to waste, by the way. You know, to subsidize and keep alive all these you know, decrepit, loss-making enterprises and to just make us all poorer. So that's the first thing. So architecture is a public art that needs to negotiate the conflict between the client, its private interest, and the public impact. And to some extent, I agree with it. Although I said there's not an absolute conflict. These private interests are, you know, business interests, meaning they are the consumers who want to purchase these apartments, who want to buy in these malls, who want to go to these entertainment places. They're the ones whose interests are served by these so-called private interests. Everybody's interest, potentially. Of course, not everybody is using everything at the same time. But of course, they have also externalities. They sit in the landscape and they're seen. They might visually pollute. And there is a collective action issue, and we can come to that at some point. But first of all, but fashion is equally public, right? Because all what we're wearing is out in the street. The streets are full of fashion. It's in our face everywhere and always. It's just the way architecture is. Right? And you might find it offensive. You might not mind. You know, a lot of people find it offensive. A girl comes with a skimpy's dress. So it is equally public. Design, you know, industrial design, everything is full. The world is full of industrial design. What I'm saying is this, that the design disciplines, which all fused and come together, urban design, architecture, industrial design, fashion design, everything design, is totally within our remit of the design disciplines, and the leaders and thinkers of this would determine the physiognomy of the built environment and the world of artifacts, everything. And it's all, in a sense, public. A few things are in the private domain. So it's not specific to architecture in this sense. We had this already. Modernism's aspiration for social progress were repudiated, by the way, by postmodernism and the triumph of the market. No, they were not. They continue by other means, these aspirations. And social progress has happened. 2015, we're hugely more wealthy. And that's, by the way, can't be measured in money, than in 1965, which is the kind of last point of reference for people like Hatherley and other nostalgic socialists, maybe for Corbyn as well. Because it's too clear for everybody to forget that the 70s were an absolute disaster in terms of the UK, for instance. But no, this continues. Social progress through, you know, these cool guys from Sergey and Larry, for instance, and what they're up to. And I don't mind any amount of money they earn. They reinvest in it anyway, in the most exciting research and campus, and you know, and they don't do evil. They don't. The evil in the whole system comes in when we have government interfering. So due to the apparent failure of the 70s modernist housing estates and the dissolution of the post-war settlement, yeah, so that reads together. I also have a point with that. I think it's fallacious too. So first of all, I think that the 70s modernist housing estates, they were hugely successful as they aligned with a certain historical era, and it wasn't an architectural issue. But they became kind of gutters of social degeneration and depravity through political conditions which the reference points of people like Corbyn and certain nostalgic lefts are responsible for. Not, I don't make them morally responsible, it's just intellectually responsible for. And these things had to change and move forward, and it's strange, but I think what is so vile and put down and with moral categories, which actually we have to suspend a little bit. I'll give with Rem, we have to kind of suspend moral and aesthetic judgment for and just look at processes and understand processes. This kind of Thatcherite neoliberal revolution, which has been seen to be kind of so amoral and horrendous, was the only way forward out of that condition. And all the remnants of these kind of historical anachronism is what is holding us back still. And that 2008 crisis, its interpretation was false. It was in fact kind of a deregular and too much capitalism. There was not enough capitalism. That's the problem. We are still having the false grasp of this. We're still trying to, in this kind of block the self-regulating mechanisms of markets. And that prevents the most advanced societies to move out of this stagnation. Architects find the traditional remit increasingly encroached by specialization of different roles within the building industry. I mean, these are the notions of Owens, and they're pervasive. Everybody's saying these kind of things. And I disagree also with this very, very much. Because I believe that specialization is progressing on and on and on, and we now have a different role, and I've been trying to define that. As architecture and urban design, the dynamism is no longer in charge of all the technical functionality issues. That is given away to engineering specialists, for instance, including now facade engineering, lighting engineering. And what we are left with, and of course also all this, those things to do with the programmatic distribution and location and synergies of urban dimension, is developers' business, and I agree that 100%. What we are now picking up on and specializing onto is our real, what we now becomes our exclusive and sole core competency, is the organizational articulation of the spatial visual field of appearances, legibility, structurations, semiologies of the built environment. It's kind of styling, if you like, as an engine and machine for social communication. And this, we have to give up this idea that everything to do with the appearances and visual presences and understanding is not in the domain of the functional. That is superbly and prominently through which built environments primarily function. I will argue that later. This image just shows you that, I mean, if we talked a bit of politics, and in this lecture I'm mixing with politics and architecture, but it's very important that they're different arenas which only start conflating if society is in turmoil, like in the late 60s. You know, you have really the politicization of everything. How you live your girlfriend, it becomes a political issue, right? And everything becomes that. And there's a little bit of that going on, and I have to be to some extent tolerant of that. But at the same time, we need to recognize if it couldn't be forever in society. We can't kind of put on hold architectural specialized discourses of experts with a nuanced reading precisely of these kind of questions. Why this curve? Why this repertoire? And why are you special? You know, you're talking something which isn't at that very moment already overtly political. And you need to be able to do that. But if it's continuously prevented because you have the pistol on your chest that you need immediately, you have a kind of political gesture to, and that means in this case people have to stop these morally irresponsible kind of forms, basically. Under this circumstance, you can't get to this discourse. But so there must be, except in absolute revolutionary situations, a division of labor in terms of discourses, and here are some of them, and that's the theory of Luhmann: politics, law, economy, science, education, and they become autonomous to a very large degree. So science goes on, and politics can't determine, you know, what is the correct theory here, there, or which direction is a more fruitful trajectory of research. You know, it would be, that's totalitarianism, is you're trying to kind of collapse all this. And these are all different subsystems, right? And science, in the inverse, can also not kind of determine what the political process has to be through some kind of sociology, science, kind of political science, kind of theory, which scientists agree and then kind of dictate. No, these are totally different language games and practices, which need to co-evolve. They only have their innovative trajectory, but I think they need to recognize that, and we as architects, and I'm added that to Luhmann's kind of oeuvre, as an architectural and design discourse, we have to recognize that we're not making politics. And it is, in any way, it's easy and cheap to, as for kind of half-educated, politically educated architect to kind of proselytize the kind of architecture students. I mean, that's not the real test for a political rigorous position. Then you need to address the political activist systems, scientists, thinkers, when you really want to test your political arguments. Right? You go into political arena proper, and I've done that a little bit. Here and there, I'm going to speak at the Battle of Ideas, and this will be kind of political debate. And I've been engaged in this for a long time. But within architecture, you can also not be kind of, you can't deliver, architecture shouldn't be usurpated by, you know, and make political problems its problems. You have their own problems in a context of what a political system evolves and delivers. And that's the real politics. And we need to some extent within architecture see where is architecture going and contributing under political conditions which we need to take as given. Because we are not in the innovative arena where this is pushed forward. That's somewhere else. And we kind of take where this other discourse has arrived at, not in its avant-gardists, but in its reality, in its current power structures. That becomes a necessary condition for what we're doing architecturally. And that can't be in any other way. Because otherwise we're just delusionally imposters and pompous, trying to kind of overturn the legitimate arrived at in current system decisions about which site, which owner, which program, I mean, you know, which brief, etc. These conditions exist in a politically properly processed and legitimized fashion, and they become conditions for us to work in. And that needs to be recognized. So I wanted to talk about freedom and order, beauty and architecture. So the concept of freedom is not only about political freedom. Freedom is something very, very universal and powerful. And it is an inevitable condition for searching out solutions of making progress, also in architecture. So, and I wanted to develop a discourse which starts with transhistorical principles and moves to concrete contemporary polemics, works from aesthetic values to demonstrable substantive performance values, how these connect and tie into each other, and are moving from the progress of civilization to the progression of architectural style. So this is a kind of a theoretical program I would like to deliver. And I have created, I mean, graph like this, and for me, progress in architecture moves from chaos to beauty. I mean, it's basically moving up from chaos to order, and as well as from kind of unfree chaos to freedom. And this is a diagram I've published in the article in the book on politics of parametricism, and I will have another up and enhanced article on this. So I want to discuss a historical trajectory of styles in that space, and basically I'm arguing that the new degrees of freedom which architecture require to address the new complexities and versatilities of the modern era through various stages had to be paid for. So we have an increase of freedom when we go from the Baroque to Classicism to Historicism to Modernism to Postmodern Deconstruction. We have more and more degrees of freedom in compositional repertoires and moves we can make to create an architectural composition, right? But we have paid for this increases in degrees of freedom. You know, what do I mean by this? For instance, if you go from Classicism to Historicism, you suddenly can move, use different styles. You have choices here. You can use a neo-Gothic, a neo-Grecian, a neo-Renaissance, so there's options. When you move into modernism, of course, you throw up overboard proportion and symmetry, and which all of these historical styles will have, and you can have much more moves to express urban compositional conditions. When you move to postmodernism, you can kind of collage and bring back all the styles of history. Plus, you have moves of interpenetration and collaging. Deconstructivism liberates us from all the historical motives which we made these more complex postmodernist conditions, and we can use all angles. We thrust things into each other, so there's much more freedom. But you can imagine each time there is less and less ordering capacity. The result is ever more versatile and rich, but ever more disordered and hard to grasp. So what I'm saying here is that we have been paying for advances in freedom by degenerating order. And you can see it in the built environment. In the final analysis, look at the built environment. It's totally, it's garbage spill, right? Identityless garbage spill. It's rich and intricate and versatile, but it's totally disordered. And that becomes a problem. I mean, it's the garbage spill and the deconstruct kind of complexity is much better than the modernist seriality and so on. But it becomes a problem. And what I'm saying here is that we moved into folding and then parametricism. Suddenly, we increased degrees of freedom clearly because now we use curvilinearity, we have NURB surfaces, we use swarms, scripts. We have much more formal repertoires, much more compositional potentials, which didn't exist in deconstructism. I mean, that's gradient, associative logics. It's tons more. But at the same time, and that's for the first time, we've vastly increased the ordering capacity of the built environment. So not only have many more degrees of freedom, but we now have new ordering potentials. You know, we're not going back to symmetry and proportion, but now we have associative logics, we have gradient scripted, all these scripted logics which enhance order, so it becomes nearly like a natural order, like nature with its endless forms, yet laws of nature determinant, cross-determining their layeredness, every single event, and make every single event retrievable, legible, navigable. This is just an argument of the superiority of parametricism, that power, that I call it the inverting of the architecture's entropy law, which was ruling for 300 years, where the built environment becomes entropic. And I was suddenly going into... So this is what beauty, in fact, means. Beauty is always that which is life-enhancing, and it moves and evolves with history, but it takes a new form, and I think we intuitively, a lot of us, I mean, parametricism, the results of parametricism are incredibly attractive to people. They're popular, they're perceived to be incredibly beautiful to many. And also the later versions are more beautiful than the earlier versions. They're more evolved, they're more dense, there's more at play. And we certainly perceive them far more beautiful than, all the other styles here, and these vernaculars and the historical, you know, we're reaching maybe something where we you know, as beautiful and more beautiful at this times. Okay, I just flick through so you can see what it was in store, and you can look at some of my you know, the trajectory I've been running, the historical trajectory. And there's a kind of voiceover, of course. You know, that's what I mean. You want to be there, but it's also at the same time it's ugly, and it could be something much more potent and powerful, which you would select over this. You certainly would move from the left to the right. I've just been in Moscow City, by the way, which is that kind of incredible pile of, you know, garbage style icons. They all cancel each other out, and it's everywhere looks the same. I mean, you know, the whole world looks like this. It's Tokyo, and it's that, right? And it's great and intense, but it's highly problematic because you don't know where's what, or what to expect. There's no inference potential, no navigable inference. And it was aestheticized in these drawings. And the only thing which was legibility to the kind of spill, and horrendous spill, but intensely inviting spill, is river. Because that river formation has a law, a logic, and it's very much like paradism, right? So that's the only thing which gives shape and navigability and it's like this. So this is what inspires us when we do our systems, right? And this is the world we nature like, which is law driven and algorithm driven, and so also the buildings in there is a complex and multifaceted, multi networked. And incredibly popular, by the way. You know, there's 7 different entrances on different levels. There are 3 museums, galleries. It becomes an icon. I mean, Koreans have the right aesthetic sensibility. The architects, when this was published, hated this. They said, it's horrendous. This will destroy the city. There's nothing to do with Asia. This is terrible. This has to be forbidden. This has to, you know, it's, you know, Roland Moore would have been, you know, petitioning against this thing. But it's been taken up immensely. 8.5 million visitors in the first year. Only the Louvre, in terms of culture, has more visitors than this. And people just adore it and love it and stimulate it and find it incredibly beautiful and potent. And the ongoings are just kind of intense, right? And this is, you know, I'm saying the built environment is a kind of navigable 360-degree interface of communication. The choices which are unfolded, you can home into. You know what's behind and how it moves and how it continues. And this is, all of our projects have this kind of character, and they're taken up, and they're working. Ron Moore is saying you can't exhibit in this. This is the kiss of death for curators, right? And by the way, these are characters we've invited. These guys, the guys who will speak in the series, they created this intervention in Maxi Museum. So, and this is the kind of spaces we want to be in. You know, suspended in all directions. You see what's going on here, 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 above, below, all around, And the last thing is, the social processes in paramedicine, we can not only just talk about them, label them, and have prejudice about them, we model them as swarm dynamics. And these crowds are architectural crowds. They are semiologically informed crowds. They're frame-dependent crowds. And it's a totally new way of taking on the social program, social functionality issues within this paradigm. So there's no way that you could kind of not participate in this, because this is global best practice. Those who don't invest in these skills will be left behind, will be clueless, and we have to make these arguments. And the tragedy is that if, yes, we're politically charged up, but if at Columbia University, at AA and other places, we don't invest in these skills, but we become kind of mediocre political debaters, there's a problem there. There's a kind of disciplinary challenge. And that's where I want to leave you with at tonight. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. For more information about the Royal Academy, please visit www.royalacademy.org.uk.